presenter is Peter Healy, who is the librarian at the Royal Astronomical Society. He just arrived after a 3.5-hour trip up from London Euston. I guess they were doing some works on the railway. So anyway, he's going to be speaking on 500 years of eclipse imagery.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jones, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a great but slightly daunting privilege to be asked to speak to this August, at this August institution, at this international meeting, and indeed in an August month. My usual audience is friendly amateur astronomers. In the professional music world, the warm-up number is the third-rate performer who was put on at the beginning to get the audience interested before the superior talents to come. I suppose by the analogy, I must be the cool-down number. Really time to go home. And I tend to feel a little like the what is supposed to follow the Lord Mayor's show. For the benefit of American guests, such as an ethnic English joke, which I'll be pleased to explain later. What I'm trying to do really is to, first of all, not merely to produce a few pretty pictures, but to argue for uses for a collection like ours, to have objective reasons for retaining, preserving, exploring, and exploiting antiquarian collections at large. There is a fundamental difference between archivists and librarians, and that is that archivists tend to want to be like Tolkien's dragon Smaug. They want to sit on their heap of gold and breathe flames over anybody who dares to go into the cave, whereas most librarians, on the whole, want to exploit their collections. It's quite the story of an Oxford College librarian many years ago who was seen striding across a quadrangle with a smile wreathing his grim features for the first time in 40 years. And when asked why Dr. Snooks was looking so cheerful, Dr. Snooks replied that he got every book back in his library except one, and he was just going to collect that. However, but I'm not that sort of librarian. I believe in exploiting, but using with respect. One of the things I really love in my job, and I'm sure I have a job that many would envy, is when one has an interested inquiry in the library, one can go around like a conjurer pulling rabbits out of the hat. And so this afternoon I'm going to show you a few of those rabbits. But why do we keep all this old stuff in the first place? I actually believe that in our collection, there is a kind of hierarchy of what we should be doing. First of all, I think we should be trying to extract any remaining real science from these printed books and archives. Obviously, archives have great potential, but I shall talk about one or two examples of real science. And the second use, I think, is not for boring old farts like me who want to write the history of astronomy. I believe that this is a huge resource for people like you to popularise real science, to get people interested, to provide an accessible entree in what is otherwise a very complicated subject. You've been hearing very technical presentations this whole weekend. I'm showing you perhaps the cultural side. And in the specific context of eclipses, I would say there's also the context of local history. Another aspect of local history is that maybe an eclipse expedition was the only really interesting thing that ever happened in a particular place, and I shall mention one or two of those later. There are many aspects to interest in historical eclipse records and archives. We can share the danger and the excitement and the challenge of getting there. We can share the lesser martyrdom of being found in us, or the even greater martyrdom of never getting home alive at all. And that did happen to more than a few people over the years. Professor Stevenson has done marvellous work, and others have done marvellous work in extracting science by, if you like, decalibrating or recalibrating historical observations. I actually believe there's quite a lot of work that could be done using a large archive of eclipse photographs, and we have a fairly considerable archive. The images are beautiful and interesting in their own right and have great potential for engaging the interest of the young committee. Not the next generation of scientists, they're already glued to their computer screens, but an interest in the literate public. They show how people view the universe, how they try to square these phenomena with their own unrealistic world systems. So there are many reasons, there are many funny stories, there are many sad stories. There are many aspects of history which can be gleaned. There is things like the Jolly Japes aspect, the enjoyment of being off the lead and away from home and away from the boss. There's the maritime history aspect, an aspect that interests me very much. So there are many, many reasons for studying historical eclipse images. Now that's a terribly good slide, so I'll leave that one out. Now the title was 1500 to 2000, as I warned the organisers, that time span was liable to expand without warning. And the first thing I pulled out is a few images from some of our rare books. You have to be a better Latinist than me to work out exactly what they're trying to demonstrate. But this really resulted from the eclipse in 1999, and it was largely a sort of self-defence mechanism to find a wider range of eclipse images which could be reproduced in books and articles and so forth. And it really led me to unformed project, a rather woolly project, to find more interesting images at large from our rare books, because you may have a catalogue which tells you that we have a copy of Sacro Bosco's Teatro de Sfera of 1482, but it doesn't tell you that this image is in it. This is from Sacro Bosco of 1482, showing the different diameter of the moon's shadow. However, there are many, many such images, and some of them highly entertaining, I think. This is from Leopold, Duke of Austria's Scientia, two versions also showing their world system as imagined at the time when the diagram of paraclipses happened. This particular one is somewhat later, it's got out of sequence. This is actually a horoscope for the eclipse of 1724. Please don't tell you that the librarian of the Royal Astronomical Society came to see you and showed you a horoscope. So people were doing these kinds of things. In fact, incidentally, John Flamsteed is supposed to have cast a horoscope for the foundation of the Greenwich Observatory, perhaps partly in fun. This is from Valerianus Petrus' Compendium de Sferum of 1537, again a diagram of how they thought eclipses might have worked. And all these are worthwhile images which can be used to demonstrate the fascination of astronomy. I think one of the diagrams Professor Stevenson showed was indeed from Appianus. This is from Appianus's Astronomicum Caesarea of 1540, Caesar's Astronomy. And it reminds us that one of the early uses of colour printing in books, of multicolour printing I should say, in books, was to chronicle eclipses, because some of the earliest black and red printing was used with woodblocks to show the red was used for the bright sun and the black was used for the dark moon. So again, so the history of book production comes into the story. Another of Appianus's diagrams. This is an absolutely fantastic book, by the way. It's about 2 foot high to the unmetricated and full of wonderful vol bells of things like planetary positions, but not really what we're talking about here. A rather irate-looking sun from Lycosthenes' book, De Prodigis, of 1557, and rather like the famous edition of the Nuremberg Chronicle, where the same woodcut is used to illustrate 147 cities. This woodblock is used to illustrate a great many eclipses. However, it is rather a striking and discomfort-looking image of the sun. And this book, of course, is not actually about eclipses, but it's Scheiner's Rosa Ursina of 1630. And now I mentioned about the idea that we can still obtain real science from printed books, even not just manuscripts. And this is a classic example. This is an extremely boring book, actually. The Rosa Ursina, the title, of course, is the emblems, the rose and the bear of Scheiner's patron family. And you have diagrams of. Hang on, sorry, wrong button. Back. The bear using projection method, suckling its young and having a zizzer, probably after a hard night observing. But it contains excruciatingly boring and lengthy Latin descriptions of what the sun was doing. And you get these wonderful diagrams about that diameter, showing the progress of sunspots across the sun's disk. You can see 27th, 28th, 30th, and 31st. And only last year, we had our copy of this book microfilmed, and it was sent to the World Data Centre for Solar Terrestrial Physics at DIDCOS, and they are deconvoluting the images so that you get a series of images of the sun's disk over a period in the 1620s to compare with Galileo's results. Some of the psychological aspects of some of these eclipse images can be rather amusing. This appears to be somebody blinded by the light, a theatrical eclipse like all this one. This is from Balbe's De Eclipsis Solari, 1662. And in 1715, a sermon was preached in St. Paul's Cathedral on the text, "Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heavens heathen are dismayed at them." And this was a sermon, warning the people not to be frightened about this eclipse. And there was great superstition about these events. What a pity we still have to do this today. And then, of course, there's that great geophysicist, Edmund Halley, with his two eclipse maps. Until recently, I thought that Halley was the very first person to produce a printed map of an eclipse track, but I now gather he's only the equal first. But referring to what Professor Stevenson remarked about tracing local reports of eclipses to get the ages, Halley also produces a map. This is a combination map of two eclipses, and asked people near the intersection of the two tracks whether they really saw the eclipse or not. And maybe we could go back in diaries and local chronicles and so on and improve on that work. I'd quite like to get, if you like, the relationship between astronomy and other cultures. This is a vignette from a work on an eclipse visible in Leipzig in 1715. And there is the Thomaskirche. And that is where J.S. Bach became cantor in 1724 and stayed till 1750. So one can use these as illuminating symptoms, if you like, or additional illustrations for other cultural aspects. This is probably a book very familiar to Richard, one of the early attempts to use Chinese observations of eclipses and similar things. I believe most of it was wrong. Again, Leadbetter's one of many, many treatises on eclipses and similar phenomena, but there are many, many such. Ferguson's Astronomy of 1756 includes these splendid diagrams of how eclipses in a realistic world system worked, and they themselves, I think, are objects of great beauty. And incidentally, this was the book from which William Herschel taught himself astronomy. A very illuminating engraving, I think. This is unfortunately from an unknown journal, which I found in our archives. It shows the astronomer as astronomy as part of the life of a cultured gentleman, and a representation of the eclipse. This has happened in August 1765, and it gives you the idea of the 18th century gentleman as an all-rounder. He had pleasure guards, he has a sage over there in his Chinese philosopher's hat, and a folly in the distance. And here, somebody observing the eclipse, considerable danger to his eyesight, and the telescope apparently has no visible means of support. So must have been rather an awe-making experience. So much more work is needed on finding these illustrations. This is John D'Aloa's eclipse treatise of 1779, with a remarkably even and consistent corona. I think he must have been a naval officer. Now, I mentioned that one of the many aspects of eclipse studies that interests me is maritime history, because both eclipses and the great age of eclipse observation in the 19th and early 20th century, and of course the two transits of Venus observations, came at times of great naval change, particularly in the 19th century with the steam and sail man of war. This is HMS Himalaya that took the British expeditions to Spain for the 1860 eclipse, which was when, as you may remember, the first the first actual photographs of the solar corona and prominences were made. And I've argued in print that this was actually the first serious conclusion from astrophotography. I published an article on this a few years back. I think the point one has to make about somewhere like the RAS collection is that the Royal Astronomical Society was a sort of place you sent things to show off. You sent your results there to announce to your peers, rather as you would write them up in astrophysical journal today, to show how much money you'd spent on your observatory and what you'd achieved. We have, for example, the original plate of the comet photograph of 1882 taken Cape Good Hope by Sir David Gill. It was sent to London to show what had happened, the photograph where Gill realised that you could actually see stars fainter than you could photograph. And it was really this photograph that led to the great age of stellar astrophotography and using photography to catalogue and make positional observations of stars. And the 1860 eclipse expedition was of great significance. These are Father Secchi's observations from Observatorio di Roma. And several years ago, we contributed to an exhibition in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, when these photographs were actually brought together for probably the very first time since 1860. And, of course, what was done, there was this tremendous argument about whether prominences were on the sun or on the moon. Secchi and Warren de la Rue were observing from about 200 miles apart, and they measured the prominences as seen on Secchi's photographs and on de la Rue's photographs, and there was definitely a parallax effect. And this was really the first time that it was definitely proven that provinces were on the sun, not on the moon. It seems a very quaint idea now to think that provinces might be on the moon, but of course there was a tremendous argument from the time that first observed. And the only other serious conclusion from astrophotography I've heard of before that was a few measures of double stars taken at Harvard and daguerreotypes. So images of great archival and almost totemic significance, I think, these pictures by Delarue and Father Secchi, and also an example of international collaboration or competition. I mentioned the local history aspect. The expedition to Spain went to a place called River Beloza, which is a fairly small village, and it was probably the most interesting thing that ever happened in River Beloza. And the expedition, as usual, took photographs of the local wildlife and the local ladies and so on. An aspect of this that you may perhaps not have heard of, and I think is very important to collect eclipse folklore if we can, and while people are still alive to do it. My friend and mentor, Dr. David Dewhurst at Cambridge, told me we had been given a Transit of Venus album, which included photographs of the local missionaries in Madagascar, I believe collected by Father Perry, to whom I'll return in a moment. And David said, some of you may know David Dewhurst, he has this rather sort of portentous way. He said, "Oh yes," he said, "Sir Arthur Eddington used to say that meetings of the Royal Astronomical Society following eclipse expeditions tended to resemble those of missionary societies," and Eddington was well acquainted with missionary societies as a devout Quaker. He said, "Because, of course, if you couldn't show photographs of the eclipse, you could always show photographs of the local inhabitants." So a bit of eclipse folklore. And another thing that studying eclipses brings out, I think, is it rescues from obscurity the most fascinating and diverse characters. This is one of these fascinating and diverse characters. This is Charles Black of Vignoles, who was actually a civil engineer, that well-known contradiction term, and he was actually busy building railways all over Spain when the 1860 eclipse was upcoming, as the Americans will say. And he, as a competent and very knowledgeable civil engineer and enthusiastic astronomer, contacted the various British protagonists and allowed them to use the railway surveys and the maps and so on that had been produced of Bilbao Railway and various others. Other English civil engineers were also busy building railways in Spain, and they applied their professional ability and their local knowledge to predicting where, much as Fred does nowadays, except much better, but to predicting where might be a good place to go, persuaded the directors of the railway company to allow the trains to be used for carrying the heavy equipment, and indeed produced a rather splendid map, which I haven't got a photograph of a whole lot, produced at his own expense, a large map about this size of Spain, all in full colour, with this splendidly embossed title page. Vignoles is mainly remembered as the person who popularised the use of flat-bottom rail on railways, but that's, he didn't actually invent it, but that's one of his sort of main claim to fame. But in the chronicles of eclipse observation, and particularly Transit Venus observation, there are innumerable interesting and out-of-the-way characters who sort of pop up at you. And in many cases, their last record is an obituary in Mathenesis. I, in my Transit Venus days, have discovered the greatest rarity known to science, which is an intellectual Royal Marine. And I mean, the Royal Marines are a hell of a good guys to have around in a tight corner, but they don't usually write papers. This chap produced 32 papers on comets and meteors. And in my job, I find an equal irritation as to the fascination of these producing these rabbits out of hats. But I see the same subjects like Caroline Herschel, the 1919 eclipse, and so on, go round and round like the smell of carrion in a ventilation system. And yet there are scores and scores of characters like this who really deserve at least a fairly good article. And I haven't got the time to write them all, so let's get on with it, chaps. This is some of the photographs that Airy went along on this expedition as well. Some of the local ladies, the local priests, the local Spanish landowners gave a great deal of assistance. I mentioned transport. Incidentally, this is a rather nice example of image manipulation. This chap here is actually Warren de la Rue, and an engraving of this photograph exists in the published report. Rather like people used to get airbrushed out of group photographs in the McCarthy era in the USA and in the communist era in Russia. In the published engraving, He's no longer there. He's there. Nice bit of. I think he probably thought he was looking a bit too relaxed in the final engraving. So perhaps we'll psychoanalyse the way people present themselves. This is the whole Eclipse Party, complete with Airy and Airy's wife and several children. But the aspect of transport also fascinates me. How the heck do you get these heavy lumps of gear to Kerguelen or Spain or Madagascar or wherever? And the fact that the Admiralty made available HMS Himalaya, the ship I showed you to start with, which was actually an aborted P&O liner. The P&O had her built. She was 4,000 tonnes, which was a hell of a size at the time. And about the time she was ready to go, the price of coal went up with a thump, so they couldn't run her profitably. The compound steam engine hadn't yet been invented, and lucky for the P&O steamship company, the Admiralty needed a troop ship. And it just happened to make this troop ship available for this expedition. And this meant that Warren de la Rue could use his native ability, engineering skill and lots of money to produce this portable dark room. And it was this portable telescope, this is actually the Q photoheliograph, and this portable dark room, which he was able to ship to Spain using the Himalaya and the frames, and assemble at Rio Beloza. And what you actually have is a sort of sailcloth cover that comes down over it. So they're able to, this is of course the age of the wet plate, and you had to sensitize, expose, and process your plate in one fluid movement before it dried out. And here's his photographic assistant coming out. This is Warren de la Rue himself over here. So again, the logistical aspects, I think, of eclipse studies can be really fascinating. Had they had to go in some little frigate, they'd have had great difficulty getting anything like this amount of weight to Spain. Now, I mentioned the lesser martyrdom of being clouded out. This is actually, I think, my favourite eclipse image. This is a drawing. I always describe this chap as the astronomical equivalent of sick as a parrot. For the benefit of our American friends, sick as a parrot is what thick British footballers say when they miss the goal. The opposite is it's over the moon. But this is Mr. James Glacier, the Greenwich Observatory Glacier. When a thick cloud hid Baby's Beads at the greatest phase of the eclipse in March 1858. He really just looked absolutely cheesed off. And his wife drew this drawing on a piece of notebook, and an annotation at the bottom says it is his affectionate wife, who did not see Bailey's Beads either, was arrested by the sight of her husband's countenance. So it was pretty cheesed off, and there must have been many, many such over the years. One could quote Professor David Fong of Amherst College, Massachusetts, who apparently went to getting on for as many eclipses as anybody else in history and was clouded out of most of them. So there are many, many such events. And there is much to be found, there's much work to be done. I mentioned the greater martyrdom. This is Father Stephen Perry, a Jesuit priest from Sturdyhurst College in Lancashire, who he was the godly one of the Perry family who invented the steel pen nib and put the quill pen out of this, which is a feather thing. And he led two government transit of Venus expeditions and four eclipse expeditions to foreign parts. And Father Perry actually died of dysentery and gangrene of the bowel 4 days after observing the eclipse in the Salut Islands in 1889. What he was sitting on to observe the eclipse, history does not relate, but it must have been jolly uncomfortable. And he actually died on board HMS Comus on her way to Demerara and was buried at Demerara. So one could claim this was a true martyr of faith and science. The reason he caught dysentery, incidentally, was that he insisted on going ashore on Devil's Island to say mass for the convicts, and also to the leper colony to say mass there, and then insisted on staying ashore to take sun sights when the sun rose, to Captain Atkinson's horror. And there's a sad little story, remembering that I mentioned that, if you like, the martyrdom of being clouded out or dying on your way home. People like Chappé d'Autoroche, who went to via California to see the 18th century transits of Venus, missed the first one, stayed 8 years to see the second one, and then died of fever before he could get home, and only the expedition's engineer got home to bring the results back to France. But Father Perry, a most remarkable chap. There's a sad little detail that is that, of course, all the Matelots used to get involved, and the ship's officers and so on used to go ashore and observe the eclipses, and Captain Atkinson called for three cheers from the ship's company. to celebrate the successful observation of the eclipse. And poor Father Perry said, alas, I cannot show, but managed to wave his hat. And then when he got to Demerara, unfortunately I didn't manage to, I went to find the ship's log of HMS Valage, which took them to Kerguelen Line for the transit. But unfortunately the ship's log of HMS Comus is not preserved. But there are many aspects, I mentioned local history, but we can find aspects in things like ship's logs, where they were involved in expeditions, where you can find details of how they got stuff ashore. Father Perry was very good at writing popular accounts, actually, of things he went on, so we have much more to go on. But anecdotal accounts of eclipse expeditions are really very few and far between, and transit observations even more. It was certainly no sinecure going to eclipses. This is a rather imaginative engraving from the 1870 eclipse of HMS Urgent in a howling gale in the Mediterranean on her way to the eclipse at Oran in North Africa. And here is another engraving, also from the Illustrated London News, of getting the gear ashore. And I think this chap here is probably still feeling rather seasick. But certainly was no joke. HMS Volage on her way back from Kerguelen Island recorded a 45 degree roll, and Jules Johnson, another great eclipse observer, was nearly lost on the way to Nagasaki for a transit of Venus when his ship was caught on the fringe of two typhoons in the South China Sea. This is a drawing from the 1870 eclipse in Cadiz by Houillier, and I do somewhat wonder what he was on to use kind of that colour. And you can find very imaginative depictions, and I get the impression they tended to sort of draw the drawing, you know, in the heat of the moment and kind of improve it as they redrew it. But there are also fascinating drawings by ship's officers who took them there. One should not forget the privately financed eclipse expedition. This was Lord Lindsay, who eventually refounded the Royal Observatory Edinburgh. This is a spy cartoon from the magazine Vanity Fair. Lindsay was a great yachtsman and took his own private yacht and his own private astronomers to Cadiz for the 1870 eclipse. This is one of the best recorded eclipses that we have. This is the Lindsay expedition. I love the posing sailors. I think they're probably Spanish sailors in this case. But you always get these chaps all striking opponents as though they don't really want you to know they're having a good time. I've not managed to identify this rather lugubrious gentleman here. I have a feeling it might be David Gill, but I'm not sure. So if anybody has any ideas. But one can find also images of really considerable beauty. And one sort of minor detail of astronomical and particularly eclipse history, which quite fascinates me, is the way that artistic skill was employed in the service of science. And quite often, conventional artists, like topographical artists, landscape artists, were taken along. And this particular watercolour of the Cadiz 1870 eclipse is actually by a chap called P.J. Naftel, who was a Guernsey born in the island of Guernsey in the Channel Islands, and mainly a landscape artist known for painting Channel Island scenes, but he went along on the 1870 eclipse expedition to sort of record, if you like, the ambience of the scene. And he is actually up on the top of the building, and in fact she got all glory flying here, because the top of the building was, presumably they got there first, the Americans got there and he bagged the best site, and there they are observing the actual eclipse. He actually did two of these, so quite a lot of artists were just taken along, rather like the botanists and so on. Now this is actually, if you like, an astronomical depiction of technophobia. And in a way it's also a crude version of what the gentleman from the Czech Republic were talking about, because in the early, rather like people like, boring old reactionary people like me, distrust computers and think they're going to glow the first time we touch them. And the early years of photography, there was great distrust of this new medium. And people thought, A, that they were going to fall off the plates in 5 minutes and disappear, and that very likely didn't happen. And B, that there was no way that photography, particularly wet and dry plate photography, could record anything like the sensitive detail that the eye can. Now there are many, for example, planetary and indeed lunar observers nowadays who would still maintain that, not perhaps eclipse observers. But this is one of a series of drawings done by a chap who was actually a professor of mine. He was a chap called W.H. Wesley, who was the Society's secretary and librarian for many long years.
And he wasn't an astronomer, but he was trained as an engraver. And he specialised in producing synoptic drawings and engravings of details of the corona and prominences from different people's photographs. These particular ones are from photographs taken at Dover Better by Lord Lindsay. But so there was this idea that you might lose the photographs. One of the 1860 photographs did actually show up before on display quite quickly. Most of the others still exist. So to try and synthesise as much detail as possible using the skill of the engraver and artist, which I think is quite a nice idea of some of the corona detail here, whether you really believe in the corona detail. Of course, two of the great eclipse observers of the 19th century, this is Sir Norman Lockyer, who appears to be competing in the eclipse observer silly hat competition. I really wish the late Spike Milligan had seen this engraving, because I'm sure he could produce a wonderful balloon. That's actually from his treatise on spectroscopy. But, of course, Lockyer was an enthusiastic and okay, wait, three more, wrong button. This is, of course, that's Lockyer in old age when he got very bad tempered and got off and found in the Norman Lockyer Observatory at Sydenham. And Lockyer and, coincidentally, Jules Janssen, the great French eclipse observer, did not collaborate, but independently discovered the idea, the way that you could use the slit of a spectroscope to observe solar prominences outside an eclipse. And this was part of the process that really undermined the scientific value of eclipses in the late 19th century. Janssen was the most remarkable chap, solar spectroscopist, particularly interested in hydrogen, balloonist, photographer, set up an observatory on the top of Mont Blanc, escaped from the siege of Paris by balloon to go and see an eclipse at Algiers, and of course it was cloudy, and many, many other achievements. Became the founding director of Meudon Observatory. So another most remarkable chap, but very keen on transits of Venus as well. And one can find these rather entertaining little relics. This is actually a medal struck with the Académie des Sciences in France, because Janssen and Lockyer quite independently thought of this method. And their letters reporting the success of the idea arrived in Paris within about a week of each other. So nobody really had the priority, and the two men became close friends. The Académie des Sciences struck this lovely medal with their two profiles. Incidentally, often miscalled the helium medal, and it wasn't for the helium, because Lockyer discovered that on his own. So another nice little relic. One of the many fascinating aspects, I think, which one can find in archives and printed things, is the public interest aspect of eclipses and transits of Venus. This is a page, probably from the Illustrated London News, showing the eclipse expedition to Siam in 1875. Incidentally, I mentioned the martyrdom of never getting home, and a king of Siam actually died of a fever, which he caught on an eclipse expedition, because he was very keen on astronomy. And rather a lovely page of engravings, probably through the Illustrated London News, we've actually got the original figure, but the astronomers just get in here at the bottom left. These are very much faraway places with strange sounding names. And you were going there, so you did all sorts of other things as well. You drew and photographed and measured and shot the local wildlife and did all sorts of things. And in this case, the astronomy has become slightly peripheral. It's a very important eclipse. One of the most entertaining eclipse expeditions, I think, is the expedition to Hvalstø in Norway in 1896. This was actually the first expedition of the infant British Astronomical Association, which I'm sure you know is the amateur wing, if you like, of British astronomy, founded in 1890. And the first major expedition they mounted was to Hvalstø. They went on the Norse King, and again, this is a fascinating example of how one can dig things out and identify them in the archives. Sir Robert Ball, the great popularizer, was one of the participants and lived up to his name in his corporation. This is another spy cartoon showing him rather similarly to a celestial globe, and here he is lecturing on the eclipse in the saloon of the Norse King, which is a private steam yacht. Ball was a most remarkable and able lecturer. On one occasion, he was supposed to have lectured to over a million people in his life. And on one occasion, he went to Leeds to give a lecture on the moon and discovered that the slides on Mars had been sent by mistake. And he said to the organizer of the local society that he was talking to, "Would you like to lecture on Mars or on the moon?" And they said Mars. So he gave a lecture on the moon, illustrating the slides of Mars. On this occasion, he was lecturing on an eclipse which he hadn't seen, so he was really quite. He had the Irish advantage, for sure. Punch is a fertile source of amusing illustrations. This is a lampoon on the 1896 eclipse exhibition. And because the eclipse exhibition is clouded out, the sun is shown here with his cool drink, and you've got the North Pole here, which is a lampoon on Amundsen, who just recently failed to reach the North Pole. So the moon and the North Pole are far from the medding crowd. I shall return to punch in a few minutes. I published this under the title of Two Weddings and a Funeral. This is a cartoon done by a newspaper illustrator of the eclipse. The two weddings were actually the fact that two astronomers met their future wives on this expedition, and a midshipman fell from the loft and was killed, so that was a funeral. And I've managed to identify that at last with the 1896 expedition. It's amazing where things turn up from. I found this in the bottom of a filing cabinet under the drawers. And this is a cartoon of an eclipse in India in the 1896, I think it is, where they're lampooning the astronomer royal, who has been pushed up the tube like a sweep's brush by some of the locals, and the dragons have flown away with the Seelestat. And they also drew this lovely drawing of Mount Sardot, sorry, 1996, and the Royal Engineers cleared an area of jungle and built this artificial hill to put the telescope cube up and then put the Seelestat on the top. And the previous cartoon is lampooning, it's dedicated to the astronomer royal. He says the dragons have flown away with his Seelestat. So, amazing where things turn up from. That's the Corona Aswan in 1905, done by an amateur artist that went along and appears to have seen, well, I'm not quite sure that those spots of mould or really stars. So, really getting towards the end of the series, eclipse observing age. This is the eclipse in Flint Island in the Pacific in 1908. We have this wonderful album of photographs of a mainly British amateur expedition. This is the SS Tavanui, which is an island steamer on which they reached this tiny remote little island. And there was also an American expedition. This is the Lick Observatory with their usual mountains of kit, and that's the Lick Observatory telescope pointing up above the palm trees. Even during the Great War, people managed to observe eclipses. This is actually John Evershed, who was the director of Kodai Canal Observatory, who'd gone up to Kashmir to observe an eclipse, complete with solar topee. Most people in Britain had other things to think about in 1917. I suppose one could claim that the last really important eclipse expedition in history was that mounted by Sir Arthur Eddington in 1919. I'm sure you all know to observe, to carry out the first critical test of relativity. And Eddington, with his famous photograph of it with his great friend Einstein. Eddington, of course, the primary expositor of relativity in English. Now, there was a severe problem about this event, because it was all mounted in a great hurry after the Great War, and there's great scientific objectivity, and there are hardly any photographs of the eclipse encampments and the equipment and so on. A few have been found. There's also a great problem with this particular image, because no actual original is known. So we still need to keep searching the trash cans. We found somebody in Kingston, Ontario, found a photograph of what might be the eclipse in the junk, literally. And it may have been left there by Dr. Douglas, who wrote Eddington's biography. We can't prove it. We think it is a photograph of the eclipse camp, so much more is needed. And I discovered in our small photographic plate archive, we only have about 6,000 glass plates, but I actually discovered first copy plates of three of the Principe images of the famous anti-trail here, because one of the sets of plates has actually lost, the Cambridge plates, and the other has been buried in a store somewhere by Peapock, and you can't get at it, so at least we can provide illustrations for publication. And there's been a recent, absolutely splendid article by Dr. Matt Stanley of Harvard, bringing out how important Eddington's devout Quaker faith was this, first of all in having been a non-combatant in the war, he's a conscientious objector, and secondly in having this desire to heal up the world, to heal the nations and to spread faith. He called it an expedition to heal the world. So that's one of the few photographs that particular one is prominent. And an often forgotten fact is that numerous expeditions are mounted through the 20s and 30s, even after the Second World War. This happens to be the Potsdam expedition in 1929, to try and redetermine the Einsteinian deflection. And a very interesting article in Vistas and Astronomy, Volume 3 on that. So this is 1922 in Wallal, Australia. So a long story to be told. Of course, the last but one eclipse in Britain was 1927, and again punch comes to the fore. Here we have a lady in cloche hat and flapper skirt saying to her obstreperous son, "If you don't behave yourself, Osbert, I shan't bring you next time." And then we also have a gentleman coming into the a caller to eminent official of Astronomical Society. "Excuse me, sir, I thought it might be of interest to you to know that there will probably be an eclipse of the sun on the 29th of this month. My colleagues say it doesn't look much like me, but..." And then I think quite an interesting area which could be of interest to the collector, which I'm not, is eclipse memorabilia. Perhaps some of you collect it. This is the Alderman Sturdy eclipse map of 1927. And there's the actual map itself. The white lines, of course, being dissected and mounted on cloth. And of course, then we got to the eclipse for this generation, and alas, it was cloudy. So we dipped out in this country, and I'm afraid librarians don't have the money to go charging around the world to see these things. Anyway, I hope I've given you an idea of the riches to be found on this, particularly on eclipse subjects in the RAS Library and Archives. Just another example of how things get dropped on one. A lady friend dropped on me, as lady friends will, a commitment to write an article with Joyter, an article on the astronomy of the Nilgiri Hills in India. Well, there's only ever been two astronomical events on the Nilgiri Hills in India. One is the building of the Ootacamund Radio Observatory, and the other was an eclipse exhibition in 1888. And having furtled around a bit in the RAS plate archives, I actually found the box of plates that General Tennant had lent to the RAS, and it said, "General Tennant lent these to the RAS, February 1888. He doesn't ever appear to have come back for them." So, again, local history of the Nilgiri Hills. There's still stuff to be done. There's still archives to be found. Only recently we were sent, through the agency of Gil Jacobs in Johannesburg, a photograph of Martha's Day, the 1874 transfer of Venus. The telescope and everything. We've got to go out and find the pictures. We've got to record the folklore, like the missionary story. Talk to people who went on eclipse exhibitions 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I'm convinced that we can use our archives, but also that people like you should be going out and searching other archives to find more of this fascinating material and bring it back and show it to us. Thank you very much.
Questions?
That was wonderful, Peter.
Thank you.
One way of distributing all these things is for you to put them all on the web.
Yes.
What's the progress in plan or plans for that?
Yes, that is a way of doing it. The Society has at the moment no definite policy about putting stuff on the web. We have web pages, and we have quite extensive web pages with a small selection of archive stuff on them. We carefully, there is the control and copyright problem, and we carefully put low resolution images on the web, and I'm regularly getting letters saying, "Do you mind if we reproduce those photographs?" So it's at the moment, I'm not doing a lot until the Society has a policy. When the Society has a policy, then I'll do it. But yes, that is indeed, it would be a great way of doing it. But what I would say is that I have been at Jim Bennett's catalogue of the archives. Jim Bennett's catalogue volume, you've sure you've got it, you've got the last memoir. I've compiled a 275-page supplement to that, which, were it not for our webmaster, would be on the web. And I'm hoping to make that available. If anybody wants one, I can send it on a floppy disk. And I have listed virtually every eclipse image we have on that. So, if anybody... Can somebody run my... Put my the pen? If I put my email here... Email me and I will send you a disk. It's the easiest thing. I mean, it's still a work in progress, but I think I've got the majority of our eclipse stuff on there.
I think it fits in perfectly with your level of technology that you were the first person in the 2 days of the meeting to use to actually write something on.
Anyway, so if anybody wants to send me an email, I'll send you or email it. It's a very large, 1.4 gigabytes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well,